Welcome to the Student Paramedic Podcast Pediatric Mini-Series with Dr. Andy Tagg. Hey team, welcome back to the Student Paramedic Podcast and our very first episode of the Pediatric Mini Series with Dr. Andy Tagg, one of the co-creators of Don't Forget the Bubbles. Now, I'm really excited. We've got an awesome selection of episodes coming up over the next few weeks, all related to the pediatric and adolescent demographic that we come across in our pre-hospital environment. Now, Andy, thank you so much for jumping on and agreeing to break all of this down for us. Do you just want to give our audience a little bit more of an insight into who you are, what you do, because it's been a few years since you've been on the podcast?
So my name's Andrew Tagg. I'm an emergency physician with a special interest in pediatrics working in Melbourne, Australia. I first got really interested in peds about 20 plus years ago. And I find children fascinating. Every single case is different. And I spend half of my shift sitting on the floor playing games and drawing pictures, and the other half of my shift looking after some really challenging cases. Not just because kids are tiny and small, but often because they can't tell you what's going on and their diseases seem to be so wildly different to what happens to grown-ups.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm really excited to chat to you over the next few weeks about all of these topics. I feel like we're going to learn a lot, and hopefully our audience does as well. And today we're going to start off with the assessment of a pediatric and how that differs from adults, because they're not just mini adults and they've got some obvious distinctions between what's sort of normal and abnormal for them. So we're going to start off with the pediatric assessment triangle, and that has been brought up in our very first episode together quite a few years back now. So if our audience wants to go back and listen to that to get some insight as well, but today we're going to go through that in a little bit more depth. So I'm really excited. So do you want to introduce, Andy, what is the pediatric assessment triangle and how do we assess children?
Yes, I think it's good to do a bit of spaced repetition. And I think the pediatric assessment triangle is a great place to start, because I think if you're not used to dealing with kids, it can be really scary going in and seeing them and knowing what's sick and not sick. And really, the pediatric assessment triangle is a great tool to use to help you get a sense of if this kid is sick or not sick and why, and potentially, you know, start some of your treatment protocols and get a sense of what's going on with them. So the pediatric assessment triangle will essentially be done at the end of the bed, from the doorway even, as you walk into a room to see a child. And it's made up of three main components: the appearance of the child, what their breathing is like, and their circulation. So if we start with appearance, really it's, you know, it's exactly what it says, you know, does that kid look sick or not sick? And sometimes that can be really hard to delineate, especially with the younger kids, because they seem to bounce from being really well one minute to incredibly snotty the next, back to, and then they'll do one of two or three things. They'll either get a lot better very, very quickly, or they'll seem to fall off down the cliff and get really, really sick. And I think as you walk into a house on a job, you know when someone is sick, really, really big sick. But it's those borderline cases where you're not sure, well, is this kid going to be okay? Are they not going to be okay? And there are some things you can look at in the appearance, their breathing, the circulation, will give you some clues. So if we're thinking about their appearance, I like to break it down into something really straightforward. And the pediatric assessment triangle gives the acronym of TICLES, which is great for when you're dealing with kids, something really easy. And TICLES stands for tone, interactiveness, consolability, look, and speech. So tone is, you know, are they floppy? Are they lying there? If their mum, or if they're lying in their mum or dad's arms, are they just resting with their head back, really barely able to hold their own head up? Are they just weak and feeble? I think interactiveness speaks for itself. As you know, when you go into that room and you call their name, are they actually going to look at you? And even down to little babies and little kids, you know that they're paying attention, they're aware of what's going on in the world. For me, as a pediatrician, I get worried when I can go along to kids, start picking them up, start undressing them, putting cannulas in them, and they don't really interact. They don't even notice. They don't appear to know what's going on. That tells me there's something going on there. There's a big problem. The C is for consolability. So kids get upset, and often they get upset with strangers arrive, and they may get very upset when they see a big white or green vehicle outside their house with blue flashing lights. That can upset them. But normally most kids are consolable. Their parents will be able to help calm them down, help them relax, let them know that everything's going to be okay. When those kids aren't consolable, they seem to be screaming and crying all the time. That's a marker that something's going on. The L in Tickle stands for look or gaze. And again, that's, are they looking around? Are they peering? Are they appear to be know what's going on in the world? Or are they staring blankly off into space like a teenager that's just not had enough sleep? And the S in Tickles is for speech. And although most of our kids that we deal with obviously can't speak, it's really about whether they are screaming or crying or aware of what's going on. Can they tell you what's happening? And again, I think we've all seen young children run around, fall over, scuff their knee, burst into tears and scream straight away. Snot running down their face, and they're looking to you to find out what's going on, and then they'll be able to tell you exactly what's going on. But the children who are properly sick, they're not able to do that. So that's appearance, and that's just one of the sort of arms of our pediatric assessment triangle. Then we've got to think about breathing. You know, obviously from the end of the bed, from the end of the from the doorway, we can tell if there's a problem with kids breathing often. And that assessment of breathing starts with just standing there and listening. So most of us, unless we're full of snot when we're breathing, have a quiet breathing pattern. But children often make some very strange, funny noises when they're breathing. So they can have a stridor, so that's an obstruction to their air going into their airways. And often that can sound like a high-pitched sort of noise. And that suggests there's a narrowing of their large upper airways. Or they can get something called stertor, which is when their noses and adenoids seem to grow and there's a blockage to their breathing out. And you might get that if they've got big, thick, swollen tonsils, or they've got a foreign body in their airway, and they may get a noise when they're trying to breathe out against that. And that's much, much harder noise to replicate. That's more of a sort of noise. So that's your stridor and stertor that you can hear often from the other side of the bed. You may hear kids coughing and wheezing, and often you may hear them coughing, and we often talk about that seal-like cough in croup. And that's something that once you've heard it, you don't often forget. You forget, but kids seem to cough for any reason whatsoever. And then you're listening for, so you've had a listen to see from the other end of the bed what they're doing, and then you can look and see if they're making an effort of breathing. When kids are really sick and exhausted, all they can really do is focus on their breathing. You may see their nostrils flaring. It's just that their body's trying and starved and crying out to get more oxygen in. You may see some sort of tracheal tug. So that if you think of the skin at the base of the neck, just sucking in. Again, their body's starving for oxygen, trying to drain in as much breath as possible. You may get some subcostal and intercostal recession as they're breathing in. And because most children are basically belly breathers, their bellies will go out and they'll suck the skin in between the ribs in as they're trying to get a really deep breath in. Often in children, an increase in respiratory rate is often one of the first markers of illness. And when the kid gets a temperature, their respiratory rate goes up. And often as part of their increased metabolic drive for any sort of medical problem, the respiratory rate will go up as well. And it's a really good sign to look out for. And so I encourage you, listeners, to really actually pay attention to what is normal and what is abnormal and sit there with your watch and ideally count them for 15 seconds, times it by four, and that'll give you a rough idea of what a kid's respiratory rate. Remembering that, you know, you or I as adults, we're breathing 12 to 16 breaths a minute, and babies will be breathing a lot more than that, and that is completely normal. So you've had a look at the end of the bed. We've got a sense of what their appearance is like. We've got a sense of what their breathing is like. Circulation's a lot harder to get a sense of, and circulation is often a little bit around about how they're doing neurologically. So if their brain is not being perfused for whatever reason, they're in a shock state, then, you know, their GCS or the level of consciousness will be lower. They'll be less interactive, but also their skin will look pale, They may look grey, they may be floppy. And so by combining appearance, breathing and circulation, you get a sense of whether a child is sick or not sick, and really what the main problem is. You know, if the problem with the child is often an appearance problem, so, you know, their tone, their irritability, their consolability, you know, those sort of problems, then often their problem, and if it's isolated just that, it's often more likely to be a neurological problem. If they've got purely just got breathing problems that you're noticing, then again, that makes sense that it might be a breathing issue. And if they've got circulatory issues, then you're thinking, well, this is a shock state for whatever reason. As children become more and more sick, they add more arms to that triangle. So you may find a child that it's both got breathing problems and circulation problems, and they're in those respiratory failure sort of settings. Or you may find a child that's got all three, and then you know they're going to be really unwell and they're going to need a lot of attention and a lot of fixing. But only really by spending some time looking at what's normal, and you get a sense of what's abnormal. And what a great game to play is every time you pick up a kid, just think, okay, what's their appearance look like? What's their breathing look like? What's their circulation look like? And do that every single time, whether it's a kid that's, you know, fallen off the monkey bars and has got a broken arm and you're taking it into hospital, or it's a, you know, a two-year-old with a wheeze. Have a think about, where is their problem? Is it an appearance problem, breathing or circulation problem?
That's fantastic. That's been really informative. So thank you for that, Andy. In regards to how long this should take as part of our initial assessment of the pediatric that we are treating, you say that it's a no-touch, sort of hands-off approach. How long should this realistically be taking at the beginning of our assessment?
That's a really good question, Alex. And realistically, that quick look takes, if you're including counting the respiratory rate, takes no more than 30 seconds. Because once you've got that information, and like a lot of things, it takes longer at first as you're getting used to things and you think, oh, what does tickle stand for again? But the more you practice it, the easier it gets. And it's almost trying to distill 20 years of pediatric practice and knowing what the difference between well and unwell is into a shorter time frame. So you can get set to go. And we've got a lot of validated data that suggests that, you know, AMBOs are amazing at doing pediatric assessment triangle, and paramedics are as sensitive as triage nurses and junior doctors at detecting if a child is unwell or not unwell, and also which sort of arm of the pediatric assessment triangle they're going down. And if you can look at a child, you'll get that snapshot view straight away. It'll take a while to get a sense of, okay, what am I looking out for appearance again? What did he say? What's the difference in tone? But the more you compare children, so you can say, I saw a child today and the tone was completely normal, happy, and you remember what a floppy looking child is, that's the easiest way. And I think maybe one useful practice tip then is when you take that child into an emergency department to get looked at, just ask someone else, one of the doctors that's seen the kid or one of the triage nurses, just to corroborate what you're saying, because you need that sense check to make sure you're getting the right idea of what's going on. It's you need some feedback when you're doing any of these sort of tools, and when you're learning, you need to know that you're right in your judgment, because otherwise it's very easy to think, oh yeah, I'm completely happy, I know exactly all about, you know, my appearance arm of the assessment triangle, but actually you don't know because you haven't seen enough floppy kids, for example.
That's fantastic advice about gaining feedback from the hospital staff and the professionals that see children day in and day out in regards to our assessment of that child and how sick that they appear. We've now done the pediatric assessment triangle. We've determined whether or not our patient is sort of sick or not sick, what might be going on. And we've ascertained that when we do this, we need to get the feedback. So now that we've done that, we need to gain a bit more information and history from our patients. What are some other important components of the pediatric assessment or the way we approach the assessment that we need to take into consideration?
Yeah, so let's break it down onto the things we want to know about in the history and then things we want to know about in the sort of examination of these children. When we think about the history, unlike when you're dealing with adults, often you have two or three people you're dealing with. You have the patient, the child in front of you. You may have a couple of parents or a parent and grandparent you also have information from, because sometimes looking after children is like being a vet, and like, you know, the kids can't tell you anything and you're just dealing with someone who's lying there looking in pain or in discomfort. And you, the best person you're going to get a history from is the parent or the carer that's been with that child. Recognizing that children don't often have a huge past medical history, it's really important to get a timeline of what's going on. And so what I often do is, you know, ask what the problem is today, but get a sense of when the child was last unwell, because it gives you a good idea of their trajectory. If a child's taken 4 or 5 days to become unwell, then that's a very different disease process to something they were completely well when they went to bed last night, and then this morning there's a problem. You're going to be thinking of very different pathologies there. Once I've got, so really what I'm going to do is I'm going to sit down, introduce myself to the carer and the child, and try and involve the kids in the conversation, even if it's just sitting there, getting down to their eye level and explaining what's going on. And, you know, you can do this with kids that, you know, up to the ages from 4 or 5 onwards, they need to know what's going on. Get down to their eye level so you're not a big, scary person in front of them. You can ask them questions, and sometimes you'll get really interesting answers because they'll tell you things that they haven't told their parents. And I remember one time I saw a child that had come in with supposed croup. And actually, you sit down with a kid and think, well, this five-year-old shouldn't have croup. They're far too old for this. And you realize what actually happened. This kid had been rolling, you know, been completely well the day before, and then been crawling around on the floor, playing, looking for bits of Lego, and had found something on the floor and put it in his mouth and actually inhaled a sunflower seed. And it only went by asking the kid what was going on, do you find out what the story is? Because as much as a parent, you like to think you're watching your children 24/7, that's not the case. And as children get older, you want to encourage them to give you the history rather first before asking the parents. And remembering that kids and parents want you to speak to them in English or in a plain language, not using jargon. One of the challenges often we have in medicine is that we use a lot of medical words as shortcuts because it makes it easy to understand for us. But, you know, if I asked a five-year-old or a seven-year-old, how many times have you urinated today? They're not going to know what I meant. But if I said, how many times have you had a wee? Great. That makes much more sense. They're going to understand what's going on. So using age-appropriate language when you're taking any of the history from the child, young person, or their parent. That would be my first top tip. I said kids don't have a huge past medical history, but if they do, remember the parents are going to be the experts in their medical condition. And so I'm really blatantly honest and say, you know much more about your child's medical health condition than I do. You've seen all the specialists. I'm sure you've done lots of reading. What do you think is going on? What are you worried about? And if you ask the parents that, they'll often tell you exactly what's going on and get it, and you'll get a shortcut into what to be concerned about. And I guarantee that when you take that child to hospital, the doctors will say exactly the same thing because the parents are still going to be the expert in their child. Likewise, sometimes you've got a child, if you're dealing with a child that's neurodiverse, they've got autism, for instance, or they've got other sensory processing difficulties. Before you even get too close to the kid, ask the mum and dad or the carer, how do they like to be talked to? How do they like to be approached? Can they speak to strangers? Do they like to be touched? Do they not like to be touched? Because the last thing you want to do is to go in like a bull in a china shop, touching a kid, trying to do their obs when it's the last thing they want and they're just going to push you away. So find out from their carers exactly how they like to be dealt with. So we've thought about a little bit about talking to them in an age-appropriate way, find about, you know, getting that past history. And then the last important question I often really want to know is, how much does this child weigh? Because everything we do in pediatrics is weight-based, and you can try and guess yourself, but we know that we're actually pretty poor at guessing as doctors and paramedics. And so what I would do is I would actually ask the parents, because that's going to be the one thing that might change your management along the way.
Those are some really fantastic points. And one thing that I really like and will take away from this as well is actually talking to the child as well about what's happened. I think sometimes we forget and we just want to talk to the parents about what's gone on and what's occurred during that particular day. So I really like that. In regards to a neonate now, they are obviously incredibly tiny. The 5-day-old, the, you know, the 1-day-old that you might go to can be incredibly scary. How does our assessment or questions change for that particular demographic?
I think that's a really good question, Alex. And I think the most important thing to think is, as you say, babies have had very little exposure to most things. They haven't built up a great immune system. And although they can appear very well one minute, they can become very unwell the next. And I have a low threshold for seeing and assessing neonates. So certainly if they're under 60 days of age and parents have told me they've had a fever, whether they've got one with you or not, believe them. And so we just assume any neonate has sepsis until proven otherwise. And I think that's, you very rarely go wrong. I think it's much better to err on the side of caution, take them in for a formal assessment. And sometimes we just need time for things to change. And so whilst you may go to a job and you'll see a kid at one point in time, they look pretty well. And the mum said, yeah, this, you know, 1 month old has had a fever at home and now has that settled down, or they've had some difficulty with breathing, or they went, you know, had blue lips and now it stopped. I would still be very cautious about leaving them at home, and I would take them in. I think that's the safest and best way. And I think just like in any child, you can use your paediatric assessment triangle to get a brief sense of what they're doing, recognizing that GCS and, you know, there's markers of level of consciousness are difficult, and remembering that really babies do just two or three things. They sleep, they feed, and they poop, and that is about it. And occasionally they cry. As long as they're doing all four of those, that's great. But if they're doing too many of any of those things, it's an issue. If they're sleeping too much, you know, they're not getting up, waking up to feed, that's often a problem. If they're pooping too much, they get dehydrated, that's a problem. If they're crying all the time, that's a problem. And not always a problem with the baby, but it also consider then what impact that is having on the parents. Because I remember when my eldest was 2 months old, and I would be, my wife would be walking around the house at 3 o'clock in the morning trying to get to sleep, and we'd be sleep deprived for weeks, and that can have problems for the parents. So there may not actually be a problem with the child, but the parent may be having challenges, and this could be their call for help.
Absolutely. Those sort of social problems that we come across, particularly in that sort of pre-hospital environment. Yeah, that's a really good point in regards to sort of more those social problems that we do come across quite a bit in the pre-hospital environment, and being aware of those things. So that's a really great point. So we've gone through the paediatric assessment triangle and some important components of assessing paediatrics. So thank you, Andy. I feel like we've sort of set up a good basis today for the rest of our series.
This is just a start, and hopefully over the next few episodes we'll cover some of the more in-depth aspects of both that assessment and history taking when we talk about some of the more common paediatric presentations.
Absolutely. I'm really looking forward to it. So thank you, Andy, for today. Now, for our listeners, please catch the next episode coming out in a week's time. And in the meantime, please check out don'tforgetthebubbles.com, because there are so many amazing resources, articles, everything on there based around paediatrics. So thank you for tuning in to the very first episode of our paediatric mini series. We hope to catch you in the next one.